ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves. We stood tall and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
I remember first reading that line and thinking, I'm in.
You realise you're reading a really remarkable book.
I knew from the very first sentence that I was in safe hands.
I'm really grateful that I picked up this book.
This is the book that I'm most excited about getting my little mitts on.
Chef's Kiss, Bellissimo, it's so good.
I've never read another book like it.
The whole novel is a soul.
All right, this is going to be good, isn't it?
Hello and welcome to our Books of the Year edition of The Bookshelf here on ABC Radio National. I'm Kate Evans.
And I'm Cassie McCullough. And yes, this is where we count down through the year. Oh, don't say countdown. It's too soon. We've only just had our top 100 countdown, haven't we?
So instead, well, we're going to talk about a collection of books. We're going to be personal, idiosyncratic. We all have our own criteria, I guess, for what makes a book memorable or surprising, audacious, or maybe giving us just what we need in our particular reading moment, Cassie. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is the 2025 Best Books of the Year edition of The Bookshelf. Let's get going.
Well, let's meet our guests, who of course have all their own reasons for making their selections. And with us today, Jason Steger, arts journalist, former book editor of The Age and Sydney Morning Herald, and a panellist on ABC TV's Book Club. Hi, Jason.
Hello there. It's lovely to be back for this very important edition.
Yeah, super great to have you. And also to have you, John Page, longtime bookseller with Pages and Pages Bookshop, a family interest, sadly no longer. And he's also the former general manager of Dimmicks Sydney, but he's now a book buyer for WH Smith. Great to have you, John.
Thank you for having me on. Looking forward to it.
And also with us is Robert Goodman, reviewer and literary judge specialising in genre fiction, a regular reviewer for the Newtown Review of Books, and he's also, we should say, very active in the ABC Book Club Facebook group, and his website is pilebythebed.com. Robert, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really pleased you're here, Robert, because your taste is quite interesting, and I say that in a good way.
John Page, before we get started, can we just ask you, as a bookseller who's worked in different types of bookshops, what does it mean to be selecting books at an airport? Do people read or buy books in a different way?
They do, yeah. No, the airport retail, which I've been doing this year, has been very different. I think there's some people that are buying a book probably for their first time in the year when they visit an airport and they're going on a holiday or they're travelling. So there's a different readership, but then also what people are reading for as well. So they're reading for entertainment. They're reading to get through either a long flight coming up or they're buying a book to read when they get to the beach at their final destination as well. So there's a little bit more entertainment, lighter books, but people do still read everything, but there's a wider, different audience that I probably haven't experienced as much in my bookselling career.
Having browsed the airport book scene a bit lately, John, I have noticed there's a lot of long tail books, ones that might have had a bit of buzz even a decade ago, that still kick around in that market.
Definitely. That was one of the big things that surprised me when I started my job at the beginning of this year, was that books that were even in our bestseller chart were books that were 5, 6, 7 years old and still going. So I think part of that as well is that word of mouth always exists, but if you're not regularly visiting a bookshop and you're only experiencing the bookshop at the airport, that word of mouth you may have heard 6 months ago, a year ago in the office, that's the time you then go, okay, now I'm going to get that book as well. So there's a book, Three Women, which was a huge bestseller
in
bookshops. It is still going through our airport bookshops today in big numbers. So it's really surprising how that long tail keeps going. And people also prefer that smaller format of a book in the airports, I found as well. What we call in the B format, the small size paperback, that really over-indexes more than I've ever seen in Dimmicks or in my own bookshop as well. Again, I think because it fits in your luggage better, it's easier to cart around. We're always trying to fit so much in that overhead locker that, you know, you don't want a big tome going in there. So you kind of do lean towards a smaller format book too.
So interesting.
But the fear, John, of running out of the book, finishing it when you've still got hours ahead on your flight, fills me with horror. So you're talking about both books that are new and seeing the long tail books. But Jason Steger, you get new releases sent to you all year. Are you seeing any particular patterns in the fiction this year?
There's an awful lot of it, a huge amount. I seem to have noticed that there are a lot of male writers being published this year and a lot of first-time women writers. But look, it's hard to pick out trends, actually, I find. I don't notice that all of a sudden, following Samantha Harvey's win last year in the Booker, that there are many books coming out about space, although there were one or two. I didn't notice that there were lots of much shorter books coming out. Book length varies such a lot. I mean, Kiran Desai, who was shortlisted for the Booker, that's a huge book. It's about 700 pages.
The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny.
Yeah. You're never going to be lonely with a book, are you? And certainly not with that one.
I feel like I've been seeing more sagas and very long books, but perhaps I'm imagining things. Robert Goodman, you particularly read genre fiction. You read crime, science fiction, fantasy. Anything that you would identify there from 2025?
For me, 2025 was really characterised by a lot of good climate fiction.
Yes.
Wild Duck Shore by Charlotte McConaughey is winning awards. I read somewhere someone said any contemporary fiction these days is climate fiction.
You have to acknowledge it.
But I think these are the ones that are set, you know, slightly into the future. Ian McEwan's new book, Arborescence, which is another one of my favourites this year, is kind of climate fiction, or it has a kind of climate element to it.
You've all set us up with things to think about, but what we'd love to do is go around everybody and get your absolute number one book for 2025.
Jason Steger, what's your number one book for 2025?
Well, I guess it is David Sholoy's Flesh, which was an extraordinary book, I thought. It won the Booker, actually. It is written in this incredibly blunt, spared-back style. The hero, István, is a young, we meet him when he's 14 or 15. He's living in Hungary in Budapest with his mother, starts an affair with an older woman on the next-door neighbour. And then from that point on, it's his rise and fall. But the interesting thing is the way Sholoy leaves a lot out of the book. So it jumps, like his earlier novel, All That Is a Man. He leaves lots of chunks out. And so you're leaping from one point to another in each of the chapters. I think István, you don't know his interior life, and yet I find that it was completely captivating, this book. And I wanted to get to the end of his story, which is, it's very eventful, and it will, I think people will like it a lot. Lots of people have liked it. It is very blokey, though, and István is incredibly, he's not very articulate, and he says okay about a million times throughout the book.
People even suggested a drinking game where you might take a drink every single time István says okay.
Oh, you'd be very drunk at the end of the book.
You certainly would, but what an extraordinary piece of writing that's sort of all about an exterior life rather than an interior one in a way that's sort of extraordinary.
It was sort of Camus-like as well, I think. It's an extraordinary book.
So, number one, David Sholoy's Flesh, John Page.
My number one pick for this year was Buckeye by Patrick Ryan. I absolutely love this book. This is what fiction really kind of means to me. It's set in a small Ohio town before, during and after the Second World War. It follows four main characters, two men, two women who are couples. You get their story about how they met, how they fall in love and get married. And then the war happens, and one of them wants to go to the war and he can't because he has a physical disability that prevents him from signing up. The other goes to war, and then it's how the world and everything else changes post that war and how these four characters change irrevocably because of what happened and the secrets that have occurred while people were off at war and what's happened in this small town. It's got all those elements in this book, and it's full of hope, it's full of grief, it's full of humour, it's full of tragedy, it's got joy, it's got heartache, and it just bursts to life every time you open the page. And I'm a huge fan of Ann Patchett and Richard Russo and Elizabeth Strout, and this kind of ticked all those boxes for me at the same time. I just absolutely did not want it to end, and there's only been one other book that's gotten close, which will be the next one that I recommend, but this was an easy one to pick as number one because it's just that great feeling when you pick up a novel and you just want to get lost in it and you want to stay in it, and that's what Buckeye by Patrick Ryan does.
Some very juicy secrets in that one too. Robert Goodman.
So my favourite book this year was an Australian book, Salvage by Jennifer Mills, which is a climate change novel. It's set in the future. It's about a woman called Jude who kind of washes up in this little community called the Freelands somewhere on the coast of Europe. And then it goes back in time to her childhood. She was orphaned. She was raised by this very wealthy family. And Mills looks at wealth disparity and all the problems associated with that. So Jude's in this community. She drives a truck. And this capsule lands in the ocean by this community. And it turns out to be her sister who went into space because that's where the wealthy people went when the climate problems hit. And it's kind of about what she does about that and her relation with the community. But the thing I really liked about this book is that a lot of climate fiction is very dark. It's like, you know, it's a dystopian. It's, you know, everybody's going to die. You know, things are going to be terrible. Whereas Jennifer Mills is much more interested in adaptation, how people live in a new way. She's very interested in community and the power of community. So there's this, you know, Jude lives in the Freelands. There's this other polity, I guess, to the north of them called the Alliance. And you kind of get this idea the Alliance is going to be this dystopian, you know, bureaucratic organizational community. And then they get there and it's actually just another way of kind of dealing with the same issues, but in a more structured way. So it's a really interesting way of dealing with climate change, and it's beautifully written. I really like Jennifer Mills. Her book, Dyschronia, which I think won awards sometime a few years back, was quite phenomenal, also a kind of a climate book. And I was really happy that my favourite book this year was Australian, because that's the first time in a long time that that's happened. So Salvage, Jennifer Mills.
Oh, what a lovely, lovely selection. Cassie McCullough, what about you? What have you loved this year?
Oh, gee. Look, this is such an arbitrary choice, isn't it? And I guess there's a number that could have been my favourite, and that's just because I'm lucky this year, I think. But I think the one I will have to nominate brings together a lot of the themes that all of you have just talked about, and it's probably no surprise, Eric Buchner's Dream State, which is set in Montana, that is the dream state, but of course it has many meanings. A dream state being maybe what we float through life in, maybe it's what we enter in our late years, maybe it's what state we're in when we fall in love. Lots of different meanings of the title. But as you were saying, Jason, that style of leaving lots of chunks out, that's what this book does. And I think Eric came to Australia and visited, and we got to talk to him at the Brisbane Writers Festival and more. And he was initially a short story collection writer. And I think that, I mean, he probably wouldn't like anyone to think this, but there is evidence of the short story format in his novel, but he's also rewritten this book numerous times and taken out whole chunks that just weren't necessary with the help and advice of his wife, which is a fairly, well, that's a pretty special relationship when someone can say, you don't need that, you know, 300 pages, but that's what happened. And so you move across time very quickly, but when you do stop in moments, it's detailed and the character development is extraordinary, but it also tells the story of the way the climate change has unfolded before our eyes in our lifetimes and in these characters' lifetimes, and it takes us also into the future. So, and also, Jason, a male writer, so there you go, on trend.
And I, when I think about Eric Puchner's Dream State, I also think of it with Patrick Ryan's Buckeye as well, because it's sort of a saga in that it covers decades and decades in the lives of these people and these families, and there's some pretty clever use of secrets that the story spins around as well. So I enjoyed both of them as well. But I'd have to say what I'm going to nominate for my book of the year is something really different, which is a work of memoir, and that's Arundhati Roy's Mother Mary Comes to Me. I mean, it is beautifully written, and it takes us into Arundhati Roy's, well, we meet her mother, who was an extraordinarily powerful, big personality, difficult person who made Arundhati Roy's life, and particularly her childhood, extremely difficult. But we see Arundhati Roy herself emerge from it, fierce, acutely observing the world, an activist, a thinker, a writer. So we see her development as a writer. But the book itself is structured around architecture. So there is a family house, and then there are tiny apartments and squats that she lives in. And the whole thing is sort of organised around the question of housing in a way that I thought was just exquisite. And I actually have a number of memoirs on my list. Hannah Kent's Always Home, Always Homesick, I really liked, and Geraldine Brooks' Memorial Days as well. And so they're all memoirs that somehow reflect on writing, grief and place all together.
Okay, well, there you go. Okay, round one successfully completed. Congrats, everyone, for getting us off and running. A reminder, of course, that you'll find the best of 2025 on the Bookshelf program page, and all the books will be listed there. So that's Christmas shopping sorted.
And so that you can keep track of them, we don't just put a long list in order. We actually list all the books under everybody's selection so that you can go,
oh gosh, no
what
pressure.
Did that, what was that guy who really knows all about genre fiction? What was he recommending for us? And so just to remind everybody, our guests are the arts journalist Jason Steger, the bookseller John Page, and the reviewer and literary judge Robert Goodman. So what's our next category? Is it just another on the list, Cassie?
Well, why don't we think about and nominate, just for a little bit of a left of field choice, what's one of the most underrated books you've read this year? First to you, Jason Steger.
Well, I was really impressed by a novel by Sean Wilson called You Must Remember This, which is about dementia. It's about Grace, who is suffering from dementia. And what I thought was fascinating about this was the way he structured the book. All the chapters are numbered, but they're not numbered in order. So you might open up the book and the first chapter is number 10. And then you go to 8, and then it goes to 1. And what he's doing with this is basically a physical representation of the confusion that Grace is experiencing in her mind. Now, in the course of this, you do get her life story, how her relationship with her husband went, how her parents treated her. I mean, but I just thought that it was a really, really well written, quite very, very moving and very, very perceptive book about dementia. And the character Grace is very much alive in her confused state.
I like that. Actually, I think dementia has been a low-level theme in a lot of the books we've read this year. Mm-hmm. And of course, as we know, its prevalence is much broader than we thought it was, and whether that's because there's more of it or because we now understand it better, who knows? But it's good to see it in writing too. Mm. What about you, John Page? You've got an underrated book that you'd like to recommend?
I've got an Australian crime novel. I think Australian crime has been going through such a great renaissance of the last decade or so, but it's also become a little formulaic, and it's all a bit the same. It's set in a landscape. It's set in a small town. It's set in the outback. There's been a plethora of those through and sold. but I'm a big fan of kind of like American noir crime, and a big fan of Peter Temple back in the day. And I have discovered this book this year, which sold well, but I think it should have gone a little bit higher. So hopefully this might get into a few people's Christmas gifts.
I've just got to stop you there. My number one choice in the top 100 books was Broken Shore, The Broken Shore by Peter Temple.
So maybe you might like this one. This is called Unbury the Dead by Fiona Hardy. It's a debut crime novel from Fiona. She's written a few children's books. She's a bookseller down in Melbourne as well. But it's one of the best crime novels I've read in a long, long time. It's very, very Jack Irish meets a bit of Dennis Lehane. And it follows two characters, Teddy and Alice, who are fixers, for want of a better term to describe their profession. They work outside the law, but they don't make a living from breaking the law per se. They find people that need to be found for other people. They clean up messes others have made. They do some driving. They do some odd jobs here and there. And they have a line that they won't cross.
Do they work in Sydney? Because
they said in Melbourne.
I could use them.
Well, they might come into state. But yeah, there's a line they won't cross, but as long as you don't cross them, if you cross them, you're in trouble. And we kind of meet them. They start off with they've got two separate jobs. Teddy's looking for a missing teenager. Alice is driving a recently deceased businessman out to the country to be married on the family home. So you can see the different kind of jobs. Well, relatively straightforward, but then both jobs go pear-shaped and kind of intersect. And this is just a cracker of a novel. The pacing's sublime. The story builds nice and not too slowly, but with lots of atmosphere and lots of layers as you get to know these two characters. And then as everything gets kind of pulled together, and the second half of the book just kind of rockets through. And it's an iconic crime series in the making, I think. I know there's more coming. She's got more written. There's going to be another one out early next year. And I really think, yeah, with how much people embrace Australian crime, this one's kind of a little bit different and will kind of tick all those kind of boxes for you as a crime reader without being the same as something you've already read before.
Okay, so that sounds great. Fiona Hardy, Unbury the Dead. And I could see you nodding, Robert.
100%. Unbury the Dead is an awesome crime debut. Alice and Teddy are like the Australian Thelma and Louise. I just love this book and I'm really looking forward to more. I think, as John said, we don't have enough metropolitan crime anymore. All of our crime fiction seems to be set in the bush. Even in Gary Dish's latest Mischance Creek, Hirsch finds some rural crime on the shelf and goes, not really into rural crime anymore. I'd love that. Saving Paul Hirschhausen isn't into rural crime anymore. I think it's great. I'm really glad that there's another one of these coming out.
But when it comes to the underrated, was there anything on your list that you think people should have paid more attention to?
So the one I thought of was a book called Picks and Shovels by Cory Doctorow. It's probably underrated because he doesn't really go through Amazon, not really big on kind of the socials. Cory Doctorow is a thinker who coined the term enshittification, which is about how everything good on the internet ends up being terrible due to kind of capitalism, I guess, and capitalist kind of push on the internet. So Picks and Shovels is the third book in his series about a forensic accountant called Martin Hench. You don't need to read them in order. This one's actually about Hench's backstory. It's set in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and it's about the rise of the personal computer industry and the app industry. Hench ends up in San Francisco in kind of the early days of Silicon Valley, working for this little startup computer firm that is taking on this much bigger computer firm, which has kind of locked people into buying their technology and their software. All of Doctorow's books are really interesting in terms of the technology that he looks at and issues of Ponzi schemes and embezzlement and use of technology to scam people. And this one's kind of about how tech giants lock you in and lock other people out. But it's also really renders San Francisco in the kind of early 80s really well, and you know, the music scene and the hippie scene and the art scene and all that kind of stuff. So Cory Doctorow, Picks and Shovels, I'm not quite sure how you find it, but you should find it.
Hopefully your local bookseller or library will be able to help you out.
Kate Evans, is there a book that you think has been overlooked this year and underrated?
Look, I was tossing up as I was looking at my list here as to whether to mention Leila Lalami's The Dream Hotel. I mean, she's a huge name, but I would have expected this very good novel to get more attention. But I'm actually going to go for one that most people won't have heard of at all, and that's Anjet Dunja's The Remembered Soldier. Now, this was a novel translated from the Dutch, a huge novel, a very good piece of historical fiction that took the experience, well, based on the real experience of some soldiers who were so damaged by World War One that they completely lost their memories and their identities. But then when they returned to society, a whole lot of different families tried to claim them because people were so traumatized, I guess, by the loss of the men in their lives that they wanted to embrace these strangers for themselves. And so she takes the story of one of these characters, and a woman comes and claims him and says, yes, he was a photographer before the war, he was my husband, and we then see him re-entering society, and we're never quite sure whether he really is the man who she claims him to be, but she very cleverly uses the story of photography to reflect the story of memory.
Mm. Yes, I remember when we spoke about that, how taken you were with it. So
it's called The Remembered Soldier, and it's by Anjet Dunja, and it's a novel in translation, and a beautiful translation too.
You're listening to The Bookshelf on ABC Radio National, or maybe via the ABC Listen app or your app of choice, your podcast collector. I don't like catcher. It makes me think of a dream catcher.
Aren't we all dream catchers here, Cassie?
Maybe once in about 25 years ago. So thank you. All these are great recommendations. I think we're going to have to put the pedal to the metal now because we are going to run out of time. So where do we go next? How about we talk about international?
I'd want to mention Colin McCann's Twist, the Irish writer, because I really loved that one. But Jason Steger, a work of international fiction.
Well, perhaps the most recent one I've read is The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny by Kiran Desai, which is this gigantic book about India, these two characters who they're both lonely and they both want partners. And I mean, there's no doubt about what happens in the course of the narrative, but it is such a vast book. And the two main characters, Sonia and Sunny, are actually probably not the most interesting characters in the book. Their relationships with their respective, Sonia with her mother, Sunny with his mother, I just thought they were wonderfully interesting, more so than the relationship that they eventually establish. But it's also about India, the class system, the question of belonging, because Sunny lives in America for quite a while in the book, and their whole family system. It's like, in a sense, one of those Russian novels, you know, how they have all the list of characters at the beginning. At the beginning of Kiran Desai's book, there are the family trees of the two main characters.
Including a dog and cat from memory in that family tree.
That's right. It is it's a capacious novel. It's got such a lot in it. And then the other international one that I loved and was very surprised by was Colm Tóibín's Long Island, because I never expected to read a sequel to Brooklyn. And it was as good as Brooklyn, I thought.
Yes, it was very good, wasn't it? I enjoyed that immensely. Mm. Yeah.
And I don't think he ever expected to write a sequel to it either, and yet he did.
He left the door open so wide, Kate.
Oh, that's a good one because, of course, it starts with a knock on the door, Long Island.
Mm.
Robert Goodman, international fiction.
I think the top of my international fiction list is We Do Not Part by Han Kang. Can't really go past going with a Nobel Prize winner.
Pretty safe territory.
she knows what she's doing.
I feel like I'm pretty safe, but it's just a beautiful novel. So it's about the massacre of civilians on the island of Jeju in the years following World War II. It's a massacre that was actually repressed by the Korean government till after 2000, actually, and they only apologised, I think, in 2013, and then the military apologised in 2019. But, I mean, the translation is beautiful as well, but it's kind of part ghost story, it's part elegy. She uses kind of the image of the snow to kind of soften and slow down the momentum of the story. And then it just, as the story goes on and she kind of layers on the actual history, the whole story really gains a lot of weight. And kind of she exposes kind of the callousness of this massacre that wiped out whole villages in this on this island in Korea. And it's just, yeah, it's a beautiful novel. Yeah.
It's both such an important piece of history that we need to confront and know about, but it is also the most extraordinary piece of literary fiction that somebody did say to me that they actually thought that it was actually a whole story from the underworld and that one of the central characters had actually died in the snow, which made me rethink the whole novel.
Yeah, so you can definitely read it that way. I mean, both the characters may well be dead. You kind of don't know and kind of doesn't matter, but it's, yeah, it gives a whole new kind of way of reading that story.
Oh, I love that. That's great.
Yeah. Nobel Prize winners, Cassie McCullough, I'm pretty sure you've got one on your list.
Indeed I do. And this, I think, is one of the very few novels I can say has come back to me many, many times this year. It's called Theft and it's by Abdulrazak Gurnah, who's a Zanzibar writer. And it tells the story of a young, well, firstly a boy and then a young man and his passage through life, which seems to sort of, he gets knocked from circumstance to circumstance without really having much control over his life. And then as the story becomes bigger and we zoom out further, we realise everything that has happened to him has happened because of colonialisation in the past. And it's the most extraordinary, just delicately structured, beautifully told, heartbreaking book about the people who have been left behind after the value has been extracted from their country and repeated attempts to get things going, to make a difference in people's lives gets trashed by another wave of a different kind of colonialisation.
And written with so much compassion and acute detail. So they're both tiny moments and it is the most expansive book. It is really quite something. John Page, international fiction, where would you like to take us?
My pick is another book, a shortlist. It was Flashlight by Susan Choi. It's the only book on the shortlist that I read, so I can't say it should have won or anything like that. But I absolutely, I love this one. I couldn't stop thinking about the book days after reading it. It primarily follows three characters, Cirque, Anne, and their daughter Louisa. And the story opens with Cirque and 10-year-old Louisa in Japan in the 1970s, walking along a breakwater wall in coastal Japan and tragedy strikes. And Louisa's found unconscious on the beach and her father is missing, presumed drowned. And the story it then centres on this cataclysmic event as we get to know Louisa, Anne and Cirque prior to this event and then in the years afterwards. And what I really loved about this was the structure. It's not told in a linear fashion. It jumps forwards, it jumps backwards. In seemingly random intervals, you kind of move really far forward in some spots and then kind of everything kind of slows down again. But each interval gives us a different perspective on each character and illuminates another kind of a piece of the puzzle of their lives, because both Anne and Cirque have got secrets from their past that they didn't share with each other, but they kind of bubble to the surface before the tragic accident. They come to the surface well after the accident as well and continue to cause ripples in all of their lives. And we just, through each of these intervals, we just learn more about who they were and the profound impact of what happened, this event, and what happened on their lives. So it's quite emotional. It's a story of love. It's a story of family as well and belonging, because really it's where do you belong in the world as well? Because Cirque is a Korean man, but he grew up in Japan but finds himself in America. Louisa is of this mixed race marriage, so it's kind of like her identity is questioned through. She questions her own identity. Where does she belong? Is she American? Is she Korean? Is she Japanese? All these other kind of questions that keep getting opened up. And the title Flashlight as well, just, it's got such great meaning through it. There's a meaning. There was a flashlight being carried when they're on the coastal walk. These intervals kind of come up like a flashlight being shined on this one scene and then the flashlight's taken away and it's shined again on another scene somewhere else. Mm. It's just really mesmerising writing. And I went back and I've found another novel of Susan Choi's, Trust Exercise, which I just finished recently, and absolute love that as well. And again, in that one, she's got this great structure of you think you're in one story and then she'll just change the perspective and you're like, oh no, it's a different story than I thought, and it still works. And she's just an amazing writer, and I'm going to read more of her books too.
And I love the way that you've completely avoided a huge chunk of Susan Choi's Flashlight, because that's part of the surprise of reading it. It becomes
well done, John.
Something well done. Else that is this whole geopolitical novel that we can't even mention without giving it away, but boy, is it good. And so, you're listening to The Bookshelf here on ABC Radio National. We're talking about our best books of 2025.
We have already touched on a few Australian books, but let's go further in it. Shall I go first? Because I want to get
Cassie.
In before everybody else on this, because I know we'll have some agreement. I loved these two books, Arborescence by Rhett Davis. I think we've already had a mention of that. This tells the story of climate change in a very creative way, very contemporary and kooky, it's got to be said. People, well, without wanting to give too much away, begin to undergo a change. I know you like this one, Robert. What did you like about it?
I love Rhett Davis's writing for a start. His book Hovering, which won Unpublished Manuscript Award a few years ago, was still one of my favourite ever books. But it's just the idea and the way he plays with the idea of what people are doing and how they're transforming and why they're transforming. And I think the other thing I liked about this book is there's another thread to it, which is about artificial intelligence, which just made me laugh out loud.
It was just so funny.
So it's kind of serious and it's humorous and it's beautifully written.
Yeah, it's definitely one of my top ones. I think it's a book for young people, maybe people in their 20s or 30s, if you're looking for a book for someone like that. I mean, it is kind of great, I think.
Because the other thing, the central relationship in the book is a really true feeling relationship as well. Like, with all this madness going on around and whatever, like the relationship between the two main characters feels very true as well.
Yes, and that's the whole book has a gentleness about it, which was very relieving, actually. I like that. Okay, good. Now, the other one I want to put on the pin board is The Transformations by the Australian writer Andrew Pippos, his second novel, which tells the story of a sub-editor in an Australian newsroom who, well, hasn't really made much of his life. He's very hesitant to step into dangerous or bold adventures, but life comes into his path in the form of a few different women, one being this woman called Cassandra, who he didn't know he liked, who'd been working alongside with for a long time, but also a daughter called Electra, who comes back into his life because she's arguing with her mum. But more than that, it's a story about what happens inside someone who's really not, there's not, from the outside, it looks like there's not that much going on, but in fact, there's a lot going on. Did anyone else read this?
I really liked it, actually. And the thing that struck me was it's the sort of complete opposite of David Sholloway's Flesh, because we learn a lot about George DeSoulis's inner life and his thoughts. And the other thing that appealed to me, having worked in newspapers for a long time, was that it's set in 2014 and on a national newspaper called The National. And it's at that moment of transformation for papers, and they're vulnerable. And so that was the whole description of George's work and life in the newspaper, and is I thought very well done. And the relationship that he establishes with Cassandra, I suppose, is also rather beautifully drawn, I thought.
Yes, I said to Kate when we were reviewing this, it's sexy.
And that's always good. But Jason, what else in when you look at the Australian fiction that you've read this year, what else would you want to have on your list?
Well, I think that in terms of an actual feel-good book, it's a kid's book, written for children, and a sequel that I wasn't expecting, and that's Runt and the Diabolical Dognapping. I don't know, Craig Silvey's... Did you read Runt, the first one?
I love both of these, Jason. They're great books. They're really good.
They are absolutely gorgeous. And I thought it was a brave, brave sequel to write, considering that it carries on almost immediately after the first one. But obviously, I can't remember when Runt, the first one, came out. But it is gorgeous. It is a gorgeous book to read. I mean, for any... any age. I've just been away overseas and I took 3 copies of Runt to give to younger members of my family. And, you know, I think anybody who has young people or old people or middle-aged people would enjoy it immensely. I'm glad you liked it, John.
Yeah, there's a bit of a Roald Dahl kind of essence to it, I think, as well, with the way Craig kind of brings the kind of the particularly the villain characters as well. I just, yeah, there's a lot of fun. And
the villains are great.
Yeah.
And yeah. Craig Silvey, of course, being the author of Jasper Jones, the sensation that was not only translated to stage but also to screen, and Honeybee, another of his, which was very popular as well.
But we always like a feel-good book of the year. But Australian fiction, John, what else is on your list?
My pick was I Want Everything by Dominic Amarina.
I was about to say that. You beat me to it. Okay, go.
I love a literary thriller, and this one is exceptional. I also love a literary kind of controversy. We all know them. And this kind of reminded me of a contemporary kind of My Life as a Fake by Peter Carey, with a touch of A Fraction of the Whole from Steve Toltz kind of thrown into it. The narrator of the novel is, you know, your classic unreliable narrator. He's a young writer who's struggling to get anything published. All his friends are getting book deals and articles published all the time, and he can't find an idea. He can't get, and when he does have an idea, he can't get it published by anyone. And then one afternoon, he sees this woman heading down to the local pool, and he's convinced it's Brenda Shales, a famous author of 2 searing novels in the 1970s, who, after legal controversies, just disappeared. So he decides that she will be his next project. If he can get to interview her and write her life, that will put him on the map. No, everyone will want to publish this book. But to get Brenda's story, he has to kind of tell a lie of omission to meet her, and then that just slowly snowballs into more lies and more deception. But he knows he's got something groundbreaking, so he can't let go of this project, of this idea, so he just keeps digging the hole for himself that little bit deeper. But then we also start to kind of question what is really going on. There's a myriad of twists and turns. There's a tension in this book that just slowly builds until this dinner party at the end, which is this brilliant crescendo for everything that was going on. I couldn't put it down. It's just, it's fun, it's twisty, it's just, it's got that little bit of everything. It's a little bit of meta because you've got writers writing about writers who are all fictional, and it's just brilliant.
Okay, so a literary mystery thriller, I Want Everything by Dominic Amarina. Good recommendation. What about you, Robert Goodman? What would you like to add?
Eden by Mark Brandy. So Eden is Brandy's kind of a sequel to Wimmera, which was his debut, which is, I think, probably still his best book. So it's about Tom Blackburn, who comes out of prison. He's not doing well. He's homeless. He ends up sleeping in the local cemetery. And through that, he ends up getting a job. But the job doesn't quite turn out to be what he expects it to be, and I just won't say any more about that.
That's great. What a great tease.
So I think the thing about Eden is that it's really spare. Like, the way Brandy writes it is quite, like, it's about people keeping secrets, and the writing kind of keeps those secrets from you. I think the other thing about Brandy's writing is that it's really compassionate. So, kind of like his book, The Rip, he kind of really gets into the lives of people who are on the margins, who are sleeping rough, who are, you know, living hand to mouth, and he deeply understands those people. He allows the reader to deeply understand them as well. And then he ties it all together with the action in Wimmera as well in a really satisfying way. So I don't think you have to have read Wimmera, but Eden by Mark Brandy.
I can hear that you like it as well, Jason Steger.
I did like it. And it's another one that it surprised me that it was, as you say, Robert, a sort of sequel to Wimmera, which, and I agree, Wimmera I thought was a really, really terrific book. I think that this one, it's sort of quiet in a way, isn't it? He writes it very delicately, I think. But the whole life of Tom in this cemetery is fantastically done, I think. He's very good, Mark Brandy. And I think maybe he doesn't get enough praise, I think.
In the underrated pile.
Mm.
And he's very good with a side character. But now that John has stolen my nomination of Dominic Amarina's I Want Everything, and I did enjoy that Mark Brandy as well, Just thinking, you know, we've been talking so much about climate fiction, and I really enjoyed James Bradley's Landfall in sort of steamy, flooded Sydney, but also Omar Moussa's Fierce Land, which wasn't so obviously a work of climate fiction, but it dealt with the environment and another sort of perspective on Australia and Australians. I also did really enjoy Madeline Gray's Chosen Family, which we spoke about recently here on the bookshelf as well. And so those four I'd probably put on my list of Australian fiction here on the bookshelf.
All right. Well, as always on our Best of the Year edition, we're running out of time. So I propose that we all just have, well, let's go for an open section to finish. Two books that you really don't want to be left off this list. Robert Goodman, let's start with you.
Okay, I'll give you two couple of speculative fiction ones. King Sorrow by Joe Hill. Joe Hill is Stephen King's little boy. He's a great writer. This is a book about six friends who make a Faustian deal with an evil dragon called King Sorrow, and it follows their lives over 40 years, and it's awesome. It's also 900 pages, so if you're looking for something big, go for King Sorrow.
I love that as well, and you'll read that 900 pages in no time because you just the pacing just does not stop.
It's amazing, and every section is written in a different style as well. It's fantastic.
Well, he's learned the master's name.
He has. He does reference King a little bit in that for the like he's written other stuff, but this is the first time he's referenced King in his, his work, so that's nice. And the other one is Shroud by Adrian Tchaikovsky. Tchaikovsky is a very prolific English science fiction writer. Shroud is a survival story. It's a first contact story. It's about these two people who are stranded on this tiny little moon that is in this machine, and they encounter these aliens. I won't say any more about it, but it's really good for sci-fi lovers.
Well, that is a lot of fun. To you, Jason Steger, which two books would you like to make sure aren't left off the list?
Well, Adam Courtney wrote a book about his father, Bryce Courtney, which was very revealing about the relationship between Bryce and his fantasy life and the real man and how difficult it was to live with him. And that was I found that fascinating. And I think the latest Slow Horses book, Clown Town by Mick Herron, he's an absolute master of spy novels, and it gave me a lot of pleasure.
Have you heard of Mick Herron, Kate?
I am busting to get to this one, Jason. It is sitting there ready for me to for my next read.
Yeah, he's great, I think.
He's really extraordinary.
Yeah.
I think he's got a bright future. All right, John Page, what about you?
I've got two. One, I think, is just probably the most important book that came out this year. It was One Day Everyone Will Have Been Against This by Omar El Card. I just think saying this is important is a gross understatement. It's angry, it's powerful, it's necessary. I don't think my words can do this book any justice, but I think Omar is a fantastic writer. I've read his fiction in the past and just this. You have to read this book.
So this is a writer who was born in Egypt, then moved to Canada and the US. He's a journalist. He's written dystopian fiction, but this is a work of nonfiction that takes on what is happening in, well, it's not just what is happening in the Middle East, it's what is happening with climate, it's what's happening politically in the world, and the argument, I guess, is that there is so much to be angry about, so much to resist, and people are looking away, but perhaps in the future we'll always claim that we knew and that we were always against this.
Yeah, so it's almost like there's a bit of a passivity in our things that we're against at the moment. Like we're, you know, and the action people are taking is not enough to prevent some of the things that have happened this year, the last couple of years, but also going all the way back to kind of 9/11, which he kind of talks about how that's shaped his view. But he wrote this amazing fiction called American War, which imagines an American Civil War, which was just an absolutely brilliant novel, which I think, again, was one of those kind of underrated books. And
it was devastating and it was brutal. And I saw him speak when he was in Australia recently. And he said that people from the West said to him, how could you do this to us? This was in his fiction. How could you write something so devastating, so brutal? People in Egypt who knew the massacres and the real events on which it was based said, why did you sanitize it? Why did you pare this back so much?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you got the criticism from both sides. which, yeah, I think, and but that is the power of this book as well, because his anger is there, but it's also, he doesn't let it overwhelm the text either. He's just a very good writer.
Okay, One Day Everyone Will Have Been Against This by Omar El Akkad, nonfiction.
And then my last pick is The Rosefield by Philip Pullman. I've been dying for this book. It's the third and final volume in his Book of Dust trilogy, which was the sequel to the Northern Lights trilogy. It's Lyra Belacqua is now an adult. Philip Pullman left us on a really big cliffhanger at the end of The Secret Commonwealth 6 years ago. So I just had to find out where this went. And again, it's the ideas, the world building, the storytelling is so packed into this book. Philip Pullman is the master of this. There's multi-universes, but I think the first series for young adults was very philosophical, and this series has been a lot more political, but in that same realm, looking at multiple worlds, religions, power, geopolitical power, and how it's used. And it's also a spy story, and because Lyra must race against time to save the world and possibly multiple others. But I've loved this series. I've kind of grown up with Northern Lights, and to kind of have it go into Lyra being an adult and the next stage is just absolutely wonderful. And if you haven't read the series, start from the beginning. If you've been dying for this like I have, the third one does not disappoint.
Okay, well, having read the Northern Lights, the whole thing, and also the first two of this trilogy, I suppose that might be hitting the beach with me.
I'm rereading the Book of Dust number one.
Yeah,
that was my
great.
Right now. Cassie, what else do you want to get to before we finish?
Okay. Look, having just read The Silver Book by Olivia Lang, I recommend that highly. It's a story about a young gay man in the 70s who's English, but for a reason that we sort of aren't certain of, ends up fleeing to Venice, where he gets in with the Italian cinema crowd, who are insane and fun and crazily kind of flamboyant, but also, Fellini's flamboyant, Pasolini not so much, but he's terrifying. It is a really interesting book. I'm going to have to squeeze in, Ian McEwan's What We Can Know. That's got to be one of the books of the year for sure.
Absolutely, definitely one of the books of the year.
Just read it. We can't explain why it's a very, very complicated backstory. It's very hard to explain.
It is, but if you like Ian McEwan, this is one of his best for a long time.
Absolutely, totally agree with you. And also, just on the international scene, I'm really cheating here. I'm going to put On the Calculation of Volume by Solveig Balle, the Danish writer. I gave this to my mum recently, and she said, "What? A book where the woman..." Oh, we can't really say, can we?
Oh, I think we can say she revisits the one day over and over and over again. And there's going to be multiple volumes of this book.
There's seven volumes of this book.
It's so clever. But again, people keep stealing my selections, Cassie. That was going to be on my final two. And I guess partly it's that it is so interesting and innovative form-wise. So I'll throw in something else that plays around with form, and that's Stephen Graham Jones' The Buffalo Hunter Hunter, which is both a work of historical fiction and it's a vampire novel. And I don't particularly like reading horror because I'm a bit of a scaredy cat, but this one won me over because you have this character who is a Native American in the late 19th century, and it's based on a series of real massacres. He survives because he becomes a vampire, and it means that the whole question of assimilation and drinking the blood of the colonized is part of the story. So that one was really innovative. And Olga Raven's The Wax Child, another piece of historical fiction that really plays around with form, and some of it is written from the perspective of a doll made of wax. So I love it when people are playful.
You know what, gentlemen? I think that we should talk to Radio National Management about this edition. Next year, why don't we just clear the entire schedule?
Whole day.
We'll just keep going. What do you think, Jason Steger?
Seems like a very good idea. There's there's so many books.
Yeah.
So many books out there to be bought for Christmas and for the beach.
And others that just deserve to be mentioned, deserve recognition because they're such high quality.
And it's particularly great that we've moved into a range of different genres as well, that we're not saying a good book has to be one type of thing. I think we've covered a reasonable ground here. So arts journalist Jason Steger, Bookseller John Page, reviewer Robert Goodman, thank you so much for joining us here on The Bookshelf.
Yeah, so great, guys. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Fun.
The Bookshelf will be back next week and, of course, all through summer as well. We'll be revisiting some of our best bookish discussions
of the
year.
You can't get away from us.
We'll be everywhere. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
She does something with her prose that I find incredibly inspiring.
The two histories kind of merge like a fresco. It's just beautiful.
Those words, I could bathe in them.
I loved it. It gripped me from beginning to end.
It was so ambitious and so impossible that you go, well, anything's possible.
And as a reader, I want that. I want it all.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.